Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Andrew David James, only on LA Talk Radio.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a day.
I know.
It's going to be a good one. Can you feel
and
that,
only
Michael?
On October 4th.
That's right. On a beautiful, although somewhat cloudy, October 4th here
what
in...
What do they call these kinds of clouds? Cumulus?
You know what's funny is my 7-year-old daughter would know. She
yes,
would absolutely
yes.
know. Yeah, they've been studying that school. I call them pretty. That's
oh,
what I call
well, there
them.
You go. That's working your way around it.
Michael, well, obviously,
I'll
here it is.
That.
October 4th, and it is time for State of the Arts.
Absolutely. We have two world-renowned and transcendent talents here to talk with us today. Dennis Danziger is in studio, and we're going to be talking to him about his current project, Double Play, in the second half of the show.
That's right. Obviously excited to get to him, but joining us on the phone now is a true legend of stage and screen. His voice, name, and face are synonymous with some of America's most beloved and critically acclaimed films. Among his many accolades, he is the recipient of the Academy Award, the Golden Globe, and a SAG Award. In addition to his illustrious career as an actor, he has served for the last 36 years as the artistic director for the Actors Gang.
Some of his many credits as an actor include Here and Now, Marjorie Prime, The Brink, Mystic River, The Shawshank Redemption, The Player, Bull Durham, and Jacob's Ladder. As a writer-director, credits include Dead Man Walking, The Cradle, Will Rock, and Bob Roberts.
He's with us today, though, to tell us about his latest directing project at the Actors Gang in the first play of their new season, Johnny Got His Gun.
Please welcome the extraordinary talent, Mr. Tim Robbins.
Yeah. Welcome. You know, they're thrilled to have you, and I think obviously their enthusiasm is coming through. How are you today, Mr. Robbins?
I'm doing great, thank you. How are you guys doing?
We're doing
great.
Fine. We are so excited about this play. Can you tell us, and the listening audience, now this is the 100-year kind of mark from the end of World War I, which I think prompted you to open your 2018-2019 season with. Am I correct?
Yes, it had, had something to do with it, but the main reason we're doing it is because this adaptation by Bradley Rand Smith is just beautiful and poetic and life-affirming and full of the amazing words of Trumbo. He's done an amazing adaptation.
Well, when you talk about Dalton Trumbo, obviously a courageous playwright and someone who broke new ground, and this piece has relevancy to today with in spades. There's a billion different connections to our world today. And you talked a little bit about the adaptation. I know that the Actors Gang has obviously been around for more than 35 years now. You started this when you were a very young actor in Los Angeles. And obviously, despite your multitude of success in film and other mediums, you've always had a heart for the theater. Can you tell me a little bit about what that meant to you and to your cohorts there, so the amazing John Cusack and so many wonderful people who are influential in film and television and theater in Los Angeles. What does the theater mean to you guys there?
Well, for me, it was always first of all, it's where I started. I started doing theater when I was 12 years old, and every summer I would do street theater in the streets of New York with a group called the Theater for the New City. So I cut my teeth with some pretty experimental, visceral theater. And so when I went to college to study theater, I was coming from a different perspective. And so the theater I embraced in my education was more European-based and more around the ideas that were brought into the theater in the early 20th century and mid-20th century by Grotowski and Meyerhold and great innovators, Brecht. And so the choice of material for the Actors Gang has always been not American realism.
Mm-hmm.
We've always been interested in trying to bring either new adaptations to classics or some kind of new approach to the original works that we were doing.
Well, now you mentioned Brecht, and I know you love Commedia dell'arte there, as well as so many other styles. And it's interesting, too, to see with a theater like that that's been meant to bring something a little bit different, the Los Angeles theater scene has really begun to thrive up around you guys. Have you seen massive changes in the last 30 years in what it means to be involved in L.A. theater?
I've always been really honored to be part of this theater community. Unlike New York, there's so much more opportunity and so much more possibility for people to really test the boundaries, to experiment, to do pieces that are not necessarily commercially viable. When you create an economic situation where it's impossible to do plays that have over two or three actors in them, it's kind of the beginning of the death of theater, because theater has a lot to say. And yes, there are a couple great plays that are written with two or three actors in them, but not a whole lot. And that's why it's really important that we still retain a certain amount of freedom and autonomy in the LA theater scene. It's something that we've been fighting our union about. It's something that the union has been obstructionist for many years on. And this idea that somehow there's going to be a whole bunch of mid-market theaters emerging if they stop the experimenting that's going on in these equity waiver theaters is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. and misses the point. The point is that actors want to be able to work. They want to be able to keep growing and trying new things. And to do a play that allows you to do a character that you might not be cast in a Hollywood movie or a television show is a great benefit for an actor. And we were fighting to protect that right of actors to have that means of expression.
I think your track record is amazing. In press notes here, it says that from 1982, you have the Actors Gang has produced over 150 productions and received more than 100 awards. So that is no small potato.
That's right. You know?
That's right. Well, thanks for acknowledging that. It's funny, when we're touring, because we tour all over the world, the last four productions I've directed have toured in five continents. We've been to China and Australia and South America, Europe, and all over North America. And it's interesting that when we go on the road, we sell out every show we're at, and we have this incredible reputation. And then Los Angeles is always a battle to get people to come on down to the show. It's not necessarily a theater town, L.A., although there's a lot of great theater in it. It's just in New York, there tends to be more of a way to spread information about the theater that is done. Mm-hmm. But that's why I'm doing the show, to get all you to come down to the Actors Gang Theater in Culver City.
Well, yes, indeed. About New York, you can smell the theater in the air. But I think we've gotten a little bit more conscientious about it in more recent years. So,
and thank you so much for doing the show and allowing the opportunity for that. It's a really important thing. I'm disappointed that, you know, when we first started, the LA Weekly would do listings. The LA Times would even do listings of non-for-profit theater. That's been removed as a way to get the information out. Our first play, Ubu the King, that we did in 1982, we had reviewers from LA Weekly, LA Reader, LA Times, LA Herald Examiner. We got the word out, and we became the Actors Gang because the press was there to recognize
right.
it.
Yeah.
And that's a function that the press, hopefully the cultural press, will hold in the future in Los Angeles. It's really difficult to get people to pay attention to theater in Los Angeles in the press.
That's
well,
right.
And
so thank you again for acknowledging it and for talking about it.
Well, thank you. We're very passionate about keeping it alive. So tell us in our audience, Johnny Got His Gun. This was a popular recruiting slogan mm-hmm. used by the U.S. military. And tell us the plot of this. It's told by a narrator, a young 20-year-old Joe Boehm is the character. Is that right?
Yes. The it's The production is set in the mind of Joe Bonham. Joe Bonham is a soldier who has survived a terrible injury in World War One,
mm-hmm.
and cannot speak, cannot hear, and has lost all of his limbs. And what happens in the course of the story is that we see not that, but we see the young Joe Bonham. We see the passionate, committed, beautiful lover of life that this kid was,
mm-hmm.
and is still. And that's, I think, what's really inspiring about this adaptation and about the what the actors are bringing to it, is that really this is a affirmation of what is important in life. It's an affirmation of our right to that, mm-hmm. our right to live life in peace without an obstacle to that freedom, and that we all have the right to love and to live life and to be present in a reality that is not consumed by politics and aggression and war. And when Trumbo wrote this, it was in 1938. He was writing it based on the accounts of a real soldier that had been injured, and due to the advancements in medical technology, had been saved. But Trumbo found this account of the spirit of this man that was so strong and so vital and so in love with life still after being injured and his body compromised, that inspiration for Trumbo was what propels the humanity in the writing in this piece. It's incredibly poetic and incredibly beautiful and mm-hmm. Incredibly moving piece of writing. Trumbo, in my opinion, is way undervalued as a writer in the United States.
Well said. And when we talk about, you know, Horton Foote and Ring Lardner and all the people who are known for so many different things, Trumbo, more than anyone, was able to encapsulate a metaphor and take a piece like this and use it not only to talk about the human spirit, but also the national spirit and hopefully what we can achieve as a nation when we get rid of obstacles and begin to move forward. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking with Tim Robbins about his play, Johnny Got His Gun, now on stage at the Actors Gang. One of the things we want to be sure to let you know is that tickets are available now. They start at $34.99. And one of the things that I love about the Actors Gang, the first way I saw a theater show here in LA when I was in college, was they give student tickets, and they've done this for a long time. So there's student tickets there. Full-time students can get tickets as low as $25. You can get out there and go see truly amazing theater, experimental theater sometimes, theater that pushes the boundaries, but always beautifully presented theater at a great, great price.
Absolutely. Excuse me. And it is on stage, as Andrew said, but not yet. Mm-hmm. October 6th through November 10th. And
yeah, we're doing our first preview this Saturday, though.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic.
Now, there are tickets
and,
available.
I also would like to mention that on Thursdays, because we've always had this belief that theater should never be simply an elitist access. On Thursdays, every production, we have a pay what you can night, which
right.
is, if you are busted and you can't afford even the $20, you can still show up and see great theater at the Actors Gang.
The tickets are available, ladies and gentlemen, online at theactorsgang.com or by telephone at 310-838-4264. And opening night and closing night tickets range from $34.99 to $50. And the Actors Gang Theater is located at 9070 Venice Boulevard in Culver City, California.
And if you haven't been down there, it's a beautiful building, obviously a historic building, lots of good stuff that goes on there. And Tim, if I can ask you one more question before you go, what do you want people to leave this show feeling?
There's a number of things. First of all, there are Joe Bonhams now in hospitals across the United States.
Mm-hmm.
There are people that are hidden from our view, people whose bodies and spirits have been compromised by their experiences in war. And we need to acknowledge these people. We need to look at that. I was opposed to the Iraq war, and I remember one of the epithets that was thrown around was that I was being disloyal somehow, or a traitor, or because I wanted to, more transparency, because I wanted to see that there was a real threat of weapons of mass destruction, as they were calling them then. And the fact is that one of the ways that they attack you is that you are not supporting the troops. And in fact, I think a full reckoning of the information that existed at the time was, in fact, supporting the troops, because wanted to make sure that if they were going to put their lives on the line, that they were doing it for a reason that was justified. And as we found out, it wasn't justified. And they used those men and women that were serving, and many lost their lives. Many people in Iraq, civilian death, lost their lives. And there has been no accounting for that. There's been no accounting for that. Think of it. How many people that deceived the public, that voted for the war, that manipulated press, that wrote outright propaganda, how many of those people actually lost their jobs? Hmm. In fact, most of them were promoted. And so here we are living in a society that doesn't have a full reckoning or accounting for the previous corruption and lies and deception, now trying to cook up another one right. in Iran.
Exactly. Well, now what I've always heard
and
from
at
you...
At some point, we have to say, no, that is enough. It has to stop. And if you really, truly want to honor and serve and respect the people that have committed their lives to serving in the military, then we need to be truthful, and we need to be honest, and we need to have a full accounting for what just happened, but also we have to recognize that supporting the troops is not just rallying up and waving a flag and getting them to go fight, but it's how they return and how they are cared for when they return.
Now,
responsible we are to that.
One of the things I've always heard from you in so many interviews and so many different writings that you've done, I've heard there's a deep love for the individual human spirit and what people have conquered, the stories that they've conquered, the things that they've come up against, the conflict that they've overcome. And I think that this play has a lot of that in it. As a director, did you want to focus on that, on how this person who so many people would think that that's as bad as it can possibly get, still somehow comes out and embraces their human spirit and has deep value to society?
Yes, because there's nothing more deeply moving than that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the things I talked about when we started with the actors, was that there is joy in this piece.
Mm-hmm.
But when you think about overall what the piece is, when I say, you know, I'm doing Johnny Got His Gun, and they think about the incapacitated soldier, what they're not thinking about is that the mind and the spirit is not incapacitated. And the mind and the spirit of Joe Bonham is so extraordinarily inspirational in the strength that he has, regardless of the challenges that he has, of his unwavering, constant belief in the human spirit and the potential of human interaction and the mm-hmm. potential of love and forgiveness. That is at the core of it. There is a great joy in the piece. And when we started embracing that element of Dalton Trumbo's writing,
mm-hmm.
the play started to have this deeply rich humanity in it. It's incredibly moving. And I feel it's something that is exactly what the Actors Gang should be doing right now. I feel it not only is a cautionary tale, but it's also something that reminds us that this guy exists. Joe Bonham exists right now. And the real question we should be asking ourselves is, why are we not seeing Joe Bonham?
Mm.
Why are we not aware of him? Why do they keep these people hidden? particularly at times when they're trying to cook up a new war.
Hmm. You can say that again, sir.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we want to again remind you about Johnny Got His Gun at the Actors Gang, obviously a staple here in Los Angeles in the American theater scene, and so many places all over the country where they've traveled shows. This piece is directed by the man we're speaking to now, Tim Robbins. We deeply encourage you to go visit theactorsgang.com, get tickets, or of course you can always call 310-838-4264.
And tickets are very affordable. You can get them seniors discount $30 and general tickets $34.99. Under 30 and full-time students $25. And then on Thursday evenings, pay what you can. But the most important thing we can say is get up off the couch, put that remote down, get in your car, and get to the theater and support the live performing arts.
That's
because
right.
If you do not do it, there will not be there in the future.
A huge thank you, Mr. Robbins, for joining us today.
My pleasure, and really beautifully put. Thank you for that support of live experiences and live theater. And by the way, we're in three dimensions. 3D.
That's
live theaters, 3D.
That's right, the original 3D. There's no doubt about it. No glasses needed. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we want to give him a big round of applause. Tim Robbins, ladies and gentlemen. Tim, we certainly wish you all the best with this production and our best for the future with the Actors Gang.
Thank you so much for having me on, and let me know when you're coming to the theater. I'd like to say hello.
That's a deal.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Wow. I mean, obviously, his portrayal of Andy Dufresne was pivotal for so many young actors coming up. I think it was a major turning point in American film. But more than that, Bull Durham is quoted at this time of year. As we start the MLB playoffs, people obviously go back to Nuke LaLoosh and all these kind of things. I think it's interesting, too, that his passion for the human spirit supersedes all of the wonderful film work he's done and really focuses on how do we value each person and how do we treat each life. I think that's such an important thing that theater brings to all of us.
No doubt about it. Very, very articulate man and well-spoken, and certainly is responsible for his success, I think, in this business. So, wow.
We have obviously a lot more to talk about, and we have a man who is absolutely as well-spoken sitting here to my right,
an amazing
playwright. I've enjoyed talking with
him
a little bit already.
Not only an amazing playwright, but a television writer, very successful.
But I got to tell you, I've met a lot of television writers. This man is a playwright. There's no doubt about it. He may be a great television writer, too, but he has the authenticity that I've always admired in all the great playwrights that I grew up reading. And certainly Dalton Trumbo is one of those. When you look at what he did in the 1930s and 40s and the way his career went and his life, and he had connections all over Southern California, but truly, I mean, some great work put out there in a difficult time when people were dealing with difficult issues, much like we are now. But ladies and gentlemen, before we get to our amazing second guest here, we want to go ahead and take a moment and we want to thank our sponsors, Michael, because if we don't, then Princess Cruises, that's right, they may come sailing in here and holler at us, and we're so grateful to them, so let's go ahead and do that.
All right. You want me to lead off there, or do you want to start?
No, I think that'd be great if you would be so kind as to lead us off there, and we will dig in.
We'd like to thank Princess Cruises, ladies and gentlemen, for coming on board. Did you get that, Dennis?
Well,
Okay. Sure. As presenting sponsors for State of the Arts during 2018, a pioneer in excellence on the high seas for meaningful travelers who seek enriching experiences, only Princess Cruises offers cruise vacations to help you come back new, providing fresh perspectives by connecting you with nature, cultures, and loved ones in a new way.
One of the best-known names in cruising, Princess Cruises first set sail in 1965 with a single ship cruising to Mexico. Today, the line has grown to become the third largest cruise line in the world, renowned for innovative ships, an array of onboard options including extravagant entertainment, and an environment of exceptional customer service. A recognized leader in worldwide cruising, Princess carries approximately 1.7 million guests each year to more than 360 destinations worldwide aboard a fleet of 17 modern vessels.
Experience the next wave in vacation travel. At the end of each month from September to August, one lucky winner will win a cruise for two in a balcony stateroom on board one of the new Ocean Medallion class ships. Make sure to enter every month for your chance to win. Now, how you do that is you come to the LATalkRadioNetwork.com on the internet here, as everything else is, and you punch up the State of the Arts page, and you will see a logo by from Princess Cruises. You click on that logo. That will take you into registering for the possibility of this win, of that beautiful $5,000 gift from Princess.
Wow, and obviously—
You can do it as many times as you like. Just keep doing it.
If you visit our page, you're going to see that Princess Cruise ship there. Just click on that, and you can zip right in and get your entry in there. Enter many, many times, because that's a great, great prize. And, of course, as always, we'd like to acknowledge PerformingArtsLive.com, one of the Internet's most prominent listing sources for the live arts here in Southern California. We're grateful to Performing Arts Live for lending their support to State of the Arts.
We are indeed.
Obviously, Michael, so many great things going on.
Yeah. I mean,
a great show we have ahead of us here. Is it all right if we go ahead and jump in and introduce this man? Because I got to tell
you, he's got a lot to tell us.
I had a chance to talk to him, and our listeners didn't get a chance to listen in on that. But we're going to cover some of this information, because truly some great things going on here, and we want to talk a little bit more about that. A graduate of the University of Texas, our next guest has enjoyed tremendous success as an author, as a television writer. Credits include Taxi, Kate and Allie, My Sister Sam, as well as some of his plays that include Almost Men, Pennant Fever, Shalom Vietnam, Richard Nixon's Sex Tapes. He also authored a novel, A Short History of the Tall Jew, A Memoir Daddy, The Diary of an Expectant Father, which I love. I think that's such a great name. He has also devoted 24 years as a teacher with the LAUSD, teaching English and sports literature, and is also an instructor for the Writing the 10-Minute Play at the Skirball Cultural Center.
Along with his wife, writer Amy Friedman, he co-founded Pops the Club, which transforms the lives of teenagers who have loved ones in prison.
For this work, he was named a Point of Light by President George H.W. Bush's volunteer organization, and along with his students, attended the Obama White House convening on criminal justice. This was a significant outreach to people who had criminal justice concerns, yeah.
He's here today, however, to talk with us, ladies and gentlemen, about his return to playwriting with his beautifully hilarious double play, making its L.A. premiere at the Stephanie Fury Theater, October 12th through November 4th. Please welcome a master wordsmith, Mr. Dennis Danziger.
Dennis, it's great to have you. Not too many Dennises out there. My father's a Dennis. Not too many Dennises out there anymore. You know, I had a little boy, and I thought about naming him Dennis, but I kind of stayed away from that because, you know, my father's name as well. And it was always interesting to me how many Dennises go out there and write. Have you ever met other writing Dennises?
No.
I've met three in my lifetime, and I always tell that story about how my father's name was Dennis. But I think there is something in a name, and I've always thought Dennis was a very scholarly name.
Thank you.
Not just because my dad's so smart. Always has something interesting to say. You got to tell me a little bit about Pops, speaking of fathers.
Yep.
Pops, the amazing organization that you formed with your wife, Amy Friedman, right. Correct? And this came from a place of understanding that having a loved one in prison drastically changes the life of the child who's left without a parent. How did that come about, and what did you want to accomplish?
It came about by accident. Well, first of all, Amy's background is that she was a journalist. She's from Cleveland, but she was a journalist in Canada, mm-hmm. and she wrote a weekly column, and she was invited into prisons to do a series of columns about prison. Long story short, she married an inmate.
Wow.
Wow.
Married
wow.
him and raised his children.
My goodness.
And what happened as she raised his children, who are now my stepchildren, they're 35 and 40-ish, but a couple of things happened. One, she lost her job. She was thrown off board. She became a person, you know, person non grata. She had been a stellar member of the community, mm-hmm. a big name writer, and suddenly she was no one.
Right.
Right. And what she also found as she was raising her children is they would never, ever talk about it.
Really?
Right. So if they were having trouble in school and kids go, oh, well, we know what's, you know, children of divorce or you're a teenager. They would never allow her to talk about the fact that their father was incarcerated.
Because it was so taboo?
It was taboo. It was this shame they carried around.
Wow.
And what she says is they became world-class liars. So when they became teenagers and were beginning to date, if a young man said, well, where's dad? The minute they asked that question, the relationship was over.
Wow.
So they carried this burden with them. That's how I became aware of the situation. I had been teaching at Palisades High, very upscale
mm-hmm.
school, and I had a class of 10th graders. And in one class, because I taught memoir writing, I had a kid from the Palisades, a very wealthy kid, who revealed in writing that his father was incarcerated for white-collar crime. In the same class, I had a Persian kid from Brentwood who revealed in a memoir, and don't share it with anybody else, but you know, whose father was in prison for environmental dumping.
Wow.
I had another kid in class who was not from the Palisades, whose father was in and out for drug dealing. So it became aware to me that only because I taught English and only because I taught memoir that I began to hear these things. Then I went over to Venice High School. It's a poor community, a higher rate of incarceration. And Amy came. We had a grant from Penn to work with one of my classes on essay writing. And as we began to write, we began to find out that there were lots and lots of people in every one of my classes who had a connection to incarceration.
And none of them mentioned it publicly. It was something that she began to see.
It came through writing. And there's a long story, but basically, one day a young lady who never spoke in class, one of my students, my most beloved students, went to prison for a long stretch.
Wow.
And I went to visit him. I had never been to prison. I was the last visitor in that day. He was the last inmate waiting.
Yeah.
He had been like a surrogate son. And when I got down to meet him, I physically didn't know who he was.
Wow.
He had lost like 40 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
So when we sat, it was Visitor's Day, when we sat, I began asking him questions to make sure it was really him.
Wow.
I went home. He wrote me a letter and said, please read this to all your students.
Wow.
And the letter was, I sat in this class a few years ago. This is not where you want to get your GED.
Mm-mm.
He said, the only thing I ever promised my mother was she would see me walk the stage.
Wow.
Now I'm not sure if I'll ever see her again. So cut the BS, cut the drugs, cut the drinking, cut the teenage drama, and even if those people, those older people in the front of the class bore you to tears, do what they say, get your education, make yourself, your proud parents proud, and if not, make me proud. Okay?
Wow.
A young lady named Kiara, who used to sit right next to me, would come in every day at 6 period after lunch and not go to sleep, but kind of pass out. She would just put her head on the desk, and sometimes we'd have to wake her when the bell rang. I just think it was PTSD.
Hmm.
So I read this letter that John had written. She sat up, and she went, my brother's in New Folsom. I wonder with John. I wonder if he knows John.
Wow.
We go up there about every month. It's a 6-hour drive. Sometimes there's a lockdown, and we have to turn around and come right back.
Oh,
yeah.
And she went on and on and on, and I looked around at my students, and I thought, is she boring them? We've never heard her speak. We've never seen her face.
Right.
And everyone's leaning in.
Wow.
Hanging on every one of her words. And I went home that night and I told Amy the story of Kiara and the letter and the kids, and she went, we're starting a club. That was 6 years ago in February.
Mm.
It started at Venice High. And now we have 8 schools here and 8 schools on the East Coast.
That's fantastic.
I wanted to jump in and cover that a little bit because I do think it's so important. I also think that it speaks to the indelible nature of the human spirit that we covered a little bit earlier in the show and how we recover from traumatic events in our lives. And I want to go ahead and mention you have a casino masquerade fundraiser coming up. Is that correct? That's on November 2nd of this year. That's a Friday night. And it's a gala. How can people find out a little bit more about that and get tickets if they wish?
Our website is www.popstheclub.com. That's where we are. If you look up Pops the Club.
Pops, P-O-P-S.
Yeah. And you'll find Casino Night. It's at the L.A. Athletic Club. And one of the main costs of Pops is we feed our students.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lunchtime club. I was at Venice High School yesterday. We have local restaurants. We make deals with local restaurants. So we feed 35 people at this club, one club every week. And so each club costs about $6,000 a year to run. So it's not just a club where you come and go bring your own lunch. It's part of the club is adults, volunteers. We serve you, your special guest. You don't have to say what brought you here. You don't have to talk about the impact of incarceration. But we have speakers. We do writing exercises, mindfulness exercises, mm-hmm. art exercises. You can participate in whatever you want. Speakers tend to come in and blow them away. Mm. And the kids over and over and over talk about when they come here, they're not judged, and they feel like family, and they feel like this burden that they've been carrying with them for years and years and years has been lifted, and they go look around and go, oh, I'm not the only one.
Yeah.
Who has a mother, a father, an uncle, a brother.
Sure.
And I can talk about it.
Sure.
So.
Wow. Important stuff.
No Thank doubt.
You. Definitely important stuff.
Well, now, coming from that, there is a play that you have written. Now, much like Da Vinci's Mona Lisa, this was not a one-week creation, as I understand.
No.
The play is called Double Play. Right. Can you tell us a little bit about it and where it's playing?
It's playing every weekend at the Stephanie Fury Theater in October, starting on the 12th.
Of October. Yes.
And it started in 1980. I wrote Act One. Act One is called, it's a love story that takes place in front of Yankee Stadium. So if you're
as all great love stories
as
should.
All they do.
Although Tim Robbins is a Mets fan, so we may not want to tell him that.
I am neither a Yankee nor a Mets.
That's because you're a Texas boy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not allowed to root for anything north of say Pennsylvania, right?
And yet it's hard to root for the Astros. It's for a team that plays indoors on AstroTurf. It's very hard.
It's great 70s uniforms you've still got to hold on to.
That look like someone dumped the condiment jar on them. They're terrible.
That's right. They're the Tampa Bay Buccaneers of the MLB. How funny. So, but Double Play started when? What year did you first write it?
I wrote it in the late 70s.
Wow.
When I was a young pup. And I had moved from the University of Texas. I'd moved to New York City, mm-hmm. and I began to go to Yankee games. And I was had a play done at HB Playwrights Foundation there in the Village, and I couldn't get any of my acting friends or my writing colleagues to go with me. So I'd go to the baseball games by myself mm-hmm. to Yankee Stadium. And the Yankees were a wonderful team back then. They were 75-79. They were beautiful, even though I grew up hating the Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
As a Southerner, we hated we just hated them. I kind of fell in love with the Yankees.
Sure.
They were wonderful. And I'm sitting at a game. It was during the pennant race, September. I remember the game. The Yankees were playing Detroit. It was a Thursday night. It was a boring game. The Yankees were destroying them. Boston. They were leaving the next day to go to Boston for a very critical series. And during the seventh inning stretch, instead of people singing, "Take me out to the ball game," the chant from the bleachers came, "Boston sucks. Boston sucks." And I'm looking around, and fathers and their little sons are yelling, "Boston sucks." And women are chanting, "Boston." And I'm going, wow, we don't do this in the South. We're much more genteel.
We write it in a letter and send it off.
I went, these people are crude, they're crazy, and I want to be one of them. and that triggered the idea, because I was growing up, I was a jock and a huge sports fan, and I thought, well, what does it take to do that? What does it take to lose yourself in the love of a team that doesn't know who you are? They don't care about you, but you know, you become this collective, you become part of their tribe, that you follow them everywhere, and you breathe life and death with this team. So that was the exploration. So it's a love story set in front of Yankee Stadium between a young woman named Rosalie Benici, who's 28, who works at a wine store. Her father, who's deceased, was a minor league ball player, never made it. And she believes that if she doesn't buy the first seat that goes on sale in the bleacher seats on the day of the crucial game, the Yankees will lose.
Mm-hmm.
It all depends on her. So
many superstitions among Yankee fans,
right.
too.
So she shows up. The play starts at 6 o'clock in the morning at a ticket booth in Yankee Stadium, where she camps out at 6 o'clock in the morning. Okay? It's kind of a tough place for anyone to hang out, right?
Yeah.
And she is met that day by a seventh-year graduate student named Herbert Scheinman, Jewish, as lonely as she is. And this is his first day of doing field research on his thesis, which is about the insanity of sports fans, and because sports ruined his life. So his thesis is really just revenge on sports fans. Neither of them probably have had a second date ever.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if either one of them had a first date.
Wow.
It was, it's in part, not based on, but inspired by Paddy Chayefsky's Marty, about two lonely
of
people
course.
Who find each other.
Yeah, yeah.
And so in Act One, we find these two sad, lonely people, one sports fanatic and one who despises anything athletic, meet, and through a mock game of baseball, they fall in love.
Wow.
That's Act One.
But there was a 30-year break between writing Act One and finding Act Two. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Tell me a little bit about how that happened.
I'm a slow typist.
I lost my ribbon.
Where was your sound cue?
That's right. Womp, womp, womp. Yeah, I've got to be faster on my board.
It was done at the Los Angeles Actors Theater in repertory with another play. And so it was fine because it was 51 minutes and there were other plays. It's a full evening. And then when it was done, someone said, well, if you want it done again, you can't ask people to leave their home and pay money and see a play that's less than an hour. You have to mm-hmm. write another play. So I tried for a couple of years to write a companion piece, and everything was awful. And when it's awful, you just throw it away. And I let it go. At the time, I was writing for TV. I didn't think about writing plays anymore. After 10 years, I stopped writing for TV and started teaching. And then I still wasn't writing plays. I wrote A Short History of a Tall Jew. And my novel. I like titles. I'm a title guy. And then, literally 32, 33 years later, Act Two was inspired by a combination of an argument with my wife and the Bush recession, which is where all great literature comes from, right?
And lots of arguments.
Yeah. I had an argument that I lost because we've been married 16 years. I am 0-93 in arguments, so I've just stopped. But I actually thought at that moment, what happens if I just leave her now? What happens? And I thought, what would my life be like? And for about 12 seconds, and I scampered back to think that was a really bad idea. But what had just gone on recently, a few years before, was the Bush recession. I knew people who were psychologists and teachers, geologists, lawyers, nurses, maintenance people, firefighters who were losing their job.
Yeah.
And I thought, what happens if you've done everything right in your life? Mm-hmm. You've lived the American dream. Both these characters are blue collar. She works in a wine store and ends up owning a bar across from Yankee Stadium. He starts out working in a coffee shop and taking 7 years to get to graduate school. He becomes an adjunct professor. Mm-hmm. They become comfortably middle class. And then the Bush recession happens. And through no fault of their own, their security is ripped from them.
Hmm.
And that's what happened to millions of Americans.
Sure.
And I think of it now, what happens to millions of Americans who, if the Republicans have their way, lose Obamacare. You're going on a path, and through no fault of your own, you're in economic dire straits. And so Act Two takes place right before they're going to demolish Yankee Stadium and they're auctioning off everything. And we see the characters, 28, they fall in love. We see the same characters, the same actors in their 50s.
Hmm.
And she has come to buy home plate.
At the original Yankee Stadium?
At the original Yankee Stadium, opening bid $18,000. Hmm. And they're in an economic downturn. And he has come to stop her.
You heard Billy Crystal's story about, you know, they used to have the monuments out in mm-hmm. center field for Yankee. And Billy Crystal says that when he went to Yankee games when he was young, mm-hmm. he thought that's where Mickey Mantle and Joe DiMaggio were buried. He thought they were running across their graves out there. It's a historic place.
He probably wasn't the only one who thought that.
Sure.
My first game ever, because in the late 50s I went to New York. We didn't have a team back then. Was Yankee Stadium.
Wow.
And I was one of those kids who sat behind a girder and couldn't see the pitcher, the third baseman. I could see the right fielder and the catcher.
Tell me quickly, who
inspired you character-wise? I mean, to write these characters,
yeah.
Was there someone specific that inspired you?
The original. The original?
Yes.
Patty Chayefsky's
Marty.
Marty is what mm-hmm. I think okay. in the background deep inspired me. But I think actually, because I think a great deal of writing is autobiographical.
True.
I think both of these characters are parts of myself.
Kind of
the warring, you know, the person who have been a fanatical sports fan, and then the other side of me that comes back and goes, they're just throwing a ball down a field. You know, what are we getting excited for?
Yeah.
I grew up playing basketball, and I played in the game here for 26 years until I decided I don't want to be the guy who gets a heart attack on the court and they have to stop the game to take me to UCLA. And then at some point when the talent starts to ebb, you go, I am running in rubber-soled shoes on a wooden court, shooting a leather ball through a metal rim with a nylon net. This is stupid, right?
Right.
So I think it was kind of the warring aspects of my mind about the love of sports and kind of the silliness of them at the same time.
Well, I'm a huge sports fan. I love the competition. I love that it's a metaphor for what used to be killing one another on the battlefield. So right. I certainly think there's value in that we've evolved in that manner. But it does seem strange when you look at the salaries and how much better we could make schools and teachers if we just balance that out a little bit. I've always thought it'd be great to start a program where one NBAer would donate a salary a year to fund so many teachers. I think that'd be a great thing.
Well, we do have a new Laker named LeBron James who just opened a school. So there are...
Excellent.
When you think of activist athletes who
are millionaires. A great point. You're right.
And my wife is a Clevelander, and I now root for all the Clevelanders. And, and remember when he first went, people were burning his jersey.
Right.
But he got a championship for Cleveland, and all is forgiven, and his politics are beautiful, and what he's done with the school is beautiful. So
I think
we
that's
will still
true.
Root for him as a Laker.
And his artistic spirit. He's invested in a number of projects that are documentary projects. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, Los Angeles has been talking about him a whole lot. And some of the documentary projects he's doing that he's not publicizing out publicly yet are going to be fantastic. They're going to change the world in a really positive way. And I think that is the new generation of athlete. The name of the play is Double Play, a great piece, and this is a full-length show, and it's playing at the Stephanie Fury Theater.
And the Stephanie Fury Theater is located at 5636 Melrose Avenue in Los Angeles, and it is one of our newer theaters, I think, that has come about in the past few years.
Well, I've had my last couple plays done there. I could tell you the great history. She's an excellent acting teacher. She has acting classes there.
It's fantastic.
Well.
And it's opening October 12th, runs through November 4th, and performances are Friday, Saturday at 8 p.m., Sunday at 2 p.m. General admission, easy breezy, $25 for adults. Mm-hmm. Running time, 120 minutes. Tickets are available at doubleplay.brownpapertickets.com.
Or you can call 323-463-7378. Again, that number is 323-463-7378.
And also, I'm going to add another telephone number that is relative to Brown Paper Tickets, because this is one of the beautiful things about using Brown Paper Tickets, is they have 24-hour customer service. Very nice people on the other end of the line. And you can call that at 800-838-3006. And purchase your tickets over the telephone.
That's right.
Night or day.
That's right. Dennis, thank you so much. So many great things that we've had a chance to talk about here today. And I know your wife, Amy Friedman, who we talked about a little bit earlier, is a writer as well and teaches as well. Is that correct?
She does.
You were telling me a little bit about some of her exercises. The love of writing and how we craft our stories has never been more important than it is right now. So thank you for pushing that forward with such a great project.
And what a TV past you've had, too, with Taxi and Kate and Allie and My Sister Sam and all of these wonderful TV shows that were a part of the landscape of television. So good luck with this show.
I hope it inspires
you enough to keep writing.
The actors, I just want to say, the actors and the director, Kim Hamilton.
Yes.
And Johnny Tchaikovsky, I love the name.
I know, right?
I just like saying Johnny Tchaikovsky. And Matthew Levitt, who's the director, are all from a company called Ammunition Theater. I don't know if you know them, but they're an amazing theater here whose mission is to put out plays that show the diversity of that theater company and the diversity of L.A., and they do, because we were talking about theaters across L.A., Ammunition Theater does incredible work.
Good to know
about it.
No doubt about it.
And now... Embarrassing
what?
Moments.
Thought we were going to get away without doing it this time. Apparently not. Dennis?
I was about to pack my backpack and go.
You're going to try to run.
Yeah.
So, Dennis, in the effort to prove that all Dennises are scholastic and not menaces, what's the most menacing thing that's ever happened to you?
The first 18 years of my life were menacing.
This is a long, embarrassing moment.
Yeah. So you want an embarrassing moment connected to...
Stage,
writing.
Film, something that's happened in your career.
You know what? When I thought about this, it's not a funny ha-ha one, and it happened recently, because when Pen and Fever, originally we moved it from L.A. Actors Theater after it was in repertory to the Beverly Hills Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And the person who was producing it, is a wonderful person, and I remember one day being young and stupid and a jerk and something that happened with the program or something that I thought was major, but in big, you know, and I kind of lost it and yelled. And then I thought, oh, God, and just like yelled at another human being I had no reason to. And I've always felt bad about it. And I don't think about it every night. It's been 38 years. I didn't hit anybody. I was stupid. I yelled.
Well, we found him on the street and we brought him in to confront you today about it.
Here's what happened is someone reviewed my play in 1980 for the LA Times, and she'd given a great review, and I saw that she's still reviewing. And I thought, well, how can I find her? Well, the young man who I yelled at now has this really cool blog that covers theater, and I went, I really want to find this woman. And I wrote him a letter, and I hadn't seen him for 38 years.
Wow.
And I went, mea culpa, mea culpa. You probably remember I was a young, hot-headed, stupid person, da-da-da, and I'm looking for this woman. And he wrote, and I was like, he'll probably just write back and go, yeah, you were a jerk. He wrote back the nicest letter and said, I remember liking the play, I remember liking you, I remember there was a dust-up. No big deal, I'm coming to the play.
Wow.
So, the power of finally saying...
Do you want to give a shout-out to his blog real quick?
It's called Next Echo.
And that's a gentleman who obviously is willing to let bygones be bygones, and we need more of that in this world. That's a great thing.
Sure do.
So check out that blog, and we want to encourage you to go check out Double Play once again. It opens up Friday, October 12th, and you can get tickets for that by doubleplay.brownpapertickets. Just visit doubleplay.brownpapertickets.
And, of course, to go see Johnny Got His Gun at the Actors Gang, which opens Saturday evening and goes into November. So
that's right. That's a great
lots
piece.
Lots of theater for you to choose from.
You can go visit the Actor Gang, the Actors Gang, at theactorsgang.com, or you can call 310-838-4264. Again, the name of the show is Johnny Got His Gun, originally written by Dalton Trumbo with an amazing adaptation here. And, of course, we have the amazing Tim Robbins who joined us today directing it. So certainly a great piece of art.
And I have my tickets for Johnny Got His Gun.
Yes,
it's my neighborhood theater, and they do exquisite work.
So maybe get an autograph from Dennis while you're there. Find him in the front row. Yeah. I think it's a great thing, too, when we talked about all these shows, and most importantly, Michael, like we always say, get out there and see some theater. Hey, real quick, what's coming up at Sterling's Upstairs?
This weekend, we have John Lloyd Young bringing in his tribute to Broadway. And do you know who John Lloyd Young is?
No, I don't.
Created the role of
Jersey
Valley.
Boy, yeah.
In Jersey Boys on Broadway and the motion picture.
Yeah.
He is a frequent headliner at my supper club in the NoHo Arts District called Sterling's Upstairs at the Federal.
So check them out on Brown Paper Tickets.
Exactly.
Brown Paper Tickets
and then we have Dr. Bradley Jones coming in with a sensational show he's just having great success with in New York.
And when does that open?
October 7th.
So let's be sure we talk about that as well. And
we
check out our website, all that sort of thing.
Sure.
Ladies and gentlemen, we want to thank you for listening today.
Yes.
My name is Andrew David James.
And I'm Michael Sterling. And where will I see you next?
On the radio.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Andrew David James, only on LA Talk Radio.